Thank you. Thanks. I'm very happy to be here. It's unusual for me when at least a third of my audience consists of collaborators and colleagues. So some of you know a great deal about this data and information because we've worked on it together. Sort of feel like Moses now, you know, crossing Moses. So a couple of years ago, when I was still in Arnie Levine's lab, we had the opportunity. Is that visible this way? Yeah. Yeah. We had the opportunity to acquire some of the. No, it says it's on. Can you hear me? Yeah. We had the opportunity to acquire some of the prototype Affymetrix gene chips, the oligonucleotide chips, which at the time were capable of measuring about 6,500 genes. Half of which were well-characterized genes, and others of which just represented ESTs, expression tags, which roughly examined corresponded with genes. So we were looking at about 3,000 known products and 3,000 probable genes at the time. And it occurred to us that using these chips, which were not yet commercially available, that using colorectal cancer as a model system to begin to understand how these chips work was an excellent idea, that colorectal cancer would be a great model system for trying highly parallel or a global gene analysis out. And that's because the tumor, as I've indicated, is common. At the time I made this slide, there were 155,000 new cases a year in the United States. This year, we expect only about 128,000 new cases. And that's because of significant advances, not so much in prevention, but in early detection and removal of the lesions before they reach a stage where they will lead to either an invasive cancer or death of the patient. So I think the right number now is in 120,000. It's a good model system also because normal tissue, early tumors, and late tumor tissues from the same patient are very abundant. It's a common tumor. The method of treating it is surgical extirpation. And so the samples are available really to anyone who is willing to take the time to forge the appropriate collaboration with surgeons and pathologists. The precursor lesion is defined, and that's important because we can use the chips then to track the stages of the cancer and hopefully begin to understand the molecular pathogenesis of this tumor. It turns out, because we know a lot about the mutations, as I'll mention in a minute, that the majority of mutations in colorectal cancer, and in fact in most cancers, ultimately regulate, are in genes which ultimately regulate transcription factors which govern RNA expression. And thus there's sort of an internal coherence to studying these tumors by studying fluctuations in their individual and global mRNA signal levels. That seems to be where the money has been, where the money will be, at least by the fact that the mutations are in transcription regulators. And finally, because of work mainly by the group coming out of Hopkins, the Vogelstein group, the DNA alterations associated with the different stages of colorectal cancer, the mutations, if you will, have been extensively characterized, and I'll show you a few in a minute, and that then makes it possible for us to know, once we've done the expression analysis, for us to correlate changes at the DNA level, the RNA level, ultimately the protein level, and the phenotype level. We can bring all this together in one nice multidimensional package. In fact, I'll argue, if you give me the chance today, that the only way to make any sense at all out of expression profiling is to correlate it with changes at the DNA level. That's the only way to separate primary from secondary changes from noise, is to correlate it with changes, either heritable or epigenetic changes at the DNA level. Okay. I thought I would begin, since I'm the academic physician among you, with a brief discussion of the clinical behavior of this tumor and of its biology, of its molecular biology, because I think that the analysis of data depends critically on an understanding, first of all, the normal biology or the normal sequence, the usual sequence of this tumor, and secondly, of all the things that can go wrong in collecting these specimens and in collecting and extracting the RNA and in measuring them, all the things that can go wrong, thereby introducing noise and bias into the system. So colorectal cancer occurs either in the colon or the rectum, and this is a barium enema of a patient. This is basically an archaic diagnostic technique that's been replaced by colonoscopy for the most part. But in this procedure, the colon is filled with barium, rendering it radio-opaque, and then you take an x-ray. This, just to orient you, is the spinal column. These are the vertebrae. These are ribs. Here's where the liver would be. The stomach would be up here. This is probably the shadow of the spleen. And this is the colon. Okay, so it's a long tube, several feet long, which begins right here at the ileocecal valve. That's where the small intestine ends. Your appendix would be over here. And it ends several meters later at the rectum. Most colon cancers occur from here down, about 60%. But we're beginning to learn now that there are a substantial minority which also occur here. And although I don't think we need to get into it, the molecular pathogenesis of tumors which occur here appears to be different than tumors which occur here. Oh, now here is a cross-section, and I wanted to show this to you to begin to introduce you to the tissue complexity. Yeah? Not really. There's a functional difference, a very large functional difference, between the small intestine and the large intestine. Although it's possible histologically to discern differences in the large bowel, and although, as I said, there's a different spectrum of cancers, different molecular spectrum of cancers, in fact, on a physiological or macroscopic basis, there's no functional difference. And you can take this part of the colon out and leave this part, or this part of the colon out and leave this part, and have an equally healthy patient. So this is a cross-section of part of the colon, and I just wanted to illustrate to you some of the tissue complexity that are involved. And we're going to spend some time on this, because it is in this complexity that much of the noise originates in the measurement of expression signals from these tissues. This is the lumen. This is where food and the fecal stream flow. It's really like a garden hose. But this is where food flows, and it's the exposure of these epithelial cells to the carcinogens contained in the fecal stream, which probably leads to colorectal cancer, combined, of course, with genetic predispositions. These are epithelial cells. I'll show you some close-ups later. It's a layer of cells which is underlain by a layer right here. You don't see it very well here, of connective tissue, right? Followed by a layer of muscle, more connective tissue, and then heavy muscle. So there are several layers of, I'll show you this in more detail in a minute, several layers of smooth muscle, several layers of connective tissue, blood vessels, and then finally the cells that we really care about, the epithelial cells. Cancer of the colon arises in this layer. Okay, cancer arises in this layer. These are lymph nodes, which are embedded in the colon. They're like Peyer's patches. This is a longitudinal slice taken from Gray's Anatomy. Again, just to illustrate to you the complexity, this would be the mucosal surface where the tumors originate. These hills and valleys sort of look like the mountains that I flew over getting into Santa Barbara last night. These are the crypts of Lieberkund seen macroscopically. Directly underneath is a layer of first connective tissue and then smooth muscle, followed by more connective tissue, followed by muscle, blood vessels to supply nutrients, and then the whole thing is sheathed in fat. If you look at a cross-section, the same kind of cross-section here, but you look at it let's say 50x, you see the epithelial cells. Under the epithelial cells is something called the lamina propria, and that's really just loose connective tissue, fibroblasts, mixed with lymphocytes, with some very small blood vessels. So it's not a homogeneous tissue. In fact, even if you do what many people think you should do, and just perform expression analysis on this layer, it's not homogeneous either. There's a stem cell compartment here where immortal stem cells divide, giving rise to daughter cells, progenitors. And as they do that, this is called the neck. As these cells divide, the cells migrate, the daughter cells migrate to the surface epithelium and ultimately undergo apoptosis and slough off into the fetal stream. And this process of new birth of cells from the stem cells to the point of death is about a week. Each of these cells carries with it a different developmental program. Each of them will have, we don't know this, this is a hypothesis, each of them will have a different expression profile. So even within the layer of cells that we call the epithelial cells, there is going to be heterogeneity and hence noise in the analysis of the expression profile. And this is actually a more substantial problem, because when we compare tumor with normal tissue, it becomes unclear what population of cells we should designate as normal. Should we take the average expression profile of all the 5 or 6 different stages? Should we take different ones and stratify them and try it out? Should we pretend there is no difference? So these are actually problems that involve a great deal of thought, and I'm not sure there's a right answer. In any case, these are the crypts of Lieberkin. These are the glands. Wherever you see white, the cells are secreting mucus, right, to help the fecal stream glide along. These are the mucus cells. And as you see, the phenotype of the cells is clearly different here, where there's a lot of mucus production, than here, where there isn't. It's clearly different. And so that's going to be reflected in a difference in the mRNA expression. This is a layer of muscle called the muscularis mucosa. It's a thin layer. This is one of those lymph glands that I showed you. And then on the other side, there'll be more connective tissue and a big, thick, rubbery layer of muscle. And here I just wanted to summarize, again, to make the point. There are epithelial cells from stem cell to mature to senescent, so it's unclear what a normal cell is. There are myocytes, fibrocytes, vascular endothelium, lymphatic endothelium, white blood cells, 10 or 20 different kinds of white blood cell, all of which are going to have different expression profiles. Serosal epithelium, the glistening surface of the intestine. There are bacteria. There are a lot of bacteria here, lots of different species, and all of them are going to contribute some expression signal, which may or may not be detected by our chips depending on how we process the RNA. So that's going to confuse things. And finally, there are complex changes in all of these cells. Now, what do I mean by that? Well, this tissue is not being examined in vitro. It's being examined ex vivo. The surgeon is going to clamp the artery supplying it. As soon as the surgeon clamps the artery, ischemic changes are going to occur. So stress proteins are going to go up. DNA is going to begin to fragment. RNA will decay. The time between the surgeon clamping the artery, getting the tumor out and throwing it into liquid nitrogen, which presumably stops this, although we really don't know that, but presumably stops this, is going to be variable. It's going to depend on lots of random factors, including what the surgeon had for breakfast, whether he's trying to teach an assistant new techniques, it might take longer, whether the liquid nitrogen in this hospital is in the room or down the hall, whether anyone cares about the experiment or lets the tissue sit on the dissecting block for an hour before they bother to freeze it. So you can understand that there are innumerable sources of noise between the biological throbbing tissue and the stage at which we even freeze it. And then, of course, are all of the sources of noise, some of which we'll talk about, between the freezing of the tissue, the thawing of the tissue, the extracting the RNA, and the final step of hybridization. Okay, so this is a very complex problem, and most of these complexities cannot be controlled in any way I can imagine. So that's the sobering part of it. Okay, now, the Vogelgram is named after Bert Vogelstein, who actually never drew this. I tried to find the reference for this, and there is no publication that I can find by Bert Vogelstein with anything similar to this in it. There's a description of what this represents, and so he's given credit for it. Now, I'll show you some images from actual patients in a minute, showing you each of these stages. But the important point here is that colorectal cancer, actually all cancer, develops along a continuum which we can operationally divide into stages, and we do. We talk about stage one squamous cell cancer, stage two. Here, we call them different things. So if you have normal epithelial tissue, it first becomes hyperplastic. It begins to overgrow. It becomes dysplastic, and dysplastic is a technical term which means that the cells become abnormal in appearance. The pathologist will look and say, this is dysplastic, it's pre-malignant. Okay, it's not malignant, it's pre-malignant. So hyperplastic, dysplastic, then an adenoma comes out. An adenoma is also called a polyp, and I'll show you one in a minute, but a polyp is a neoplasm, it's a new growth. 1 in 1,000 to 1 in 10,000 will become malignant and cause cancer. Okay, and that's why, I don't know how many of you have had your colonoscopies, you're supposed to have them every year after the age of 50, that's what they're looking for. They're looking for adenomas so they can take them out before they become cancer. That's what the whole business is about. And it's because this is becoming more frequent that the rate of cancer is decreasing in America. If you take the adenoma out, you prevent cancer that time. Okay. The adenoma will turn into a cancer, the cancer will invade and eventually metastasize and kill the patient. As the degree of transformation from normal to malignant increases, the number of mutations increases. And as you'll see on the next slide, it's possible to fill in each step now with specific mutations. Now, I didn't think that we would really focus on this, but if people are really interested in this diagram, I can give you a reference on a web where you can download it. So don't try to write it down. Now, as you may know, there are two molecular trajectories that a colon cancer can follow going from normal epithelium to metastases. There's the classical pathway, which was discovered many years ago, which begins with a mutation in APC, the adenomatous polyposis coli gene. If you're born with this mutation, you only have to knock out another allele, and so you'll have thousands of adenomas by the time you're 20, and 100% chance of colon cancer by the time you're 40. If you acquire this mutation in your colon cells because the fecal stream has incited a mutation, that's the normal way that people sporadically develop colon cancer. If any of us get it, there's an 80% chance that's the way we'll get it. Another mechanism of developing colorectal cancer, recently described, better prognosis, tends to be on the right side of the colon, involves first a mutation in a mismatch repair gene, so that the normally occurring background mutations in DNA can't be repaired. And so the tumor goes along a slightly different trajectory, leading to the same end. Okay? And I'm not going to really spend much more time on the details of this. I wanted to get across the point, however, that we know the sequence of inactivations, right? Although each individual mutation is stochastic, taken as a whole, it forms a coherent picture. And this is thought to be the usual sequence. Yes?
Is this diagram causal? I mean, is it mutation in APC later on causing mutation in KRAS? Or is it just a coincidence of chances that the mutation is occurring in the same cell?
Okay, so the answer is both. It's causal in the sense that a mutation in APC facilitates the occurrence or the growth of a hyperplastic epithelium and an adenoma, which sets the stage for the KRAS mutation. There's not a known biochemical link between APC and KRAS, for example. Right? The other sense in which it's causal is that a KRAS mutation may not have an effect unless it's occurring in the background of a previous APC mutation. And that's clearly true for P53. A P53 mutation in the germline, in all of these cells, right, will not cause an adenoma. It does not cause colon cancer. Okay? The P53 mutation only causes the transition from adenoma to carcinoma in the background of all of these existing mutations. It's really stochastic, and I mean that's the clonal theory of tumor. The clonal theory of carcinogenesis states that a single mutation occurs that gives a small growth advantage. I might actually have a No, I don't have a picture of that. A small growth advantage to that clone of cells. That clone of cells begins to overtake cells without a mutation. Because of its enhanced growth rate, and perhaps because DNA repair is slightly perturbed in that line of cells, a second mutation stochastically occurs in that clone, giving a further growth advantage. And so gradually you end up here. These mutations, APC mutations, which are not followed, say, by KRAS mutations, ultimately fail, and the clone dies out. So another way to put this is to say that this recapitulates Darwinian evolution, right? Natural, a stochastic change in DNA followed by natural selection of the best fit, most fit group of cells. Okay, I thought it would be amusing to go over some pictures of these so you can sort of make it concrete. This is an image taken from a colonoscopy. So the physician has inserted a fiber optic tube into the colon and is looking. He's actually stained this with iodine so you can see these glands. This is the normal appearance of the colon. This is the epithelium we were looking at before. And these are patulous fat glands sort of pouting out at you, right? Puckering. And these are hyperplastic glands. They're the first stage in the transition to cancer. This is very small, probably a millimeter. If you look, this is normal epithelium with well-differentiated goblet cells. This is from these crypt cells, from this abnormal. And you can see, I think, that there's been a de-differentiation. These cells are no longer making mucus as efficiently. So there's already been a perturbation in the normal biochemistry of the cell. In addition, the nuclei are scattered randomly. They're not polarized the way they should be. And if you get a feel for it, you can see that the ratio of nucleus to cytoplasm is big. The nuclei are abnormally big. All of these will tell a pathologist that these cells are premalignant. And this is what a polyp looks like. This is a section of colon taken out. And this is a polyp. This is a different section close up. And it grows on a little stalk. And this thing is sort of waving in the fecal stream. And because it's now sticking up, it's more exposed to carcinogens than it was before. So that's another sense in which these initial mutations are causal. This shows a section of the polyp. You see the glands are disorganized. They're not lined up neatly the way they're supposed to be. They're pointing in different directions. They don't make mucus. A pathologist in a second would say, oh, this is an adenomatous premalignant mucosa. If that's taken out, the patient is cured. If it's not taken out, this is what can happen. This is a cancer. This is the colon, right? That's been taken out and filleted open. And this is the cancer. This is a Duke stage B tumor. And here's the tumor microscopically. And I think you can get the idea. This would be the lumen. This would be the outside of the wall. This cancer is now digging in through the muscularis, penetrating the bowel wall on its way to spread. Now, the importance of looking at this image for us today is for you to appreciate how heterogeneous this is. Right? This tumor is not just epithelial cells, which we pretend it to be. This tumor contains, when I take this block, right, I give it to my friend Uri and he's going to do an expression analysis, he will find tissue that contains epithelial cells, both normal and malignant. There's some normal over here, malignant. The tumor has induced formation of blood vessels and lymphatics to service its need. Remember, a cancer doesn't just exist as a cell. A cancer is an organ that's trying to form in the wrong place. So this tumor is trying to recapitulate its development, its embryonic development. And it knows that it has to have a blood supply. It has to have lymphatic drainage. It has to be invested with smooth muscle. So it tries to induce the other principal germ layers to produce these elements for it. All of those are part of the tumor, right? There's muscle, there's fibrous tissue, there are blood vessels. And on top of that, there's the normal tissue that you're grabbing hold of when you take a section. And on top of that, there is all of the host defense mechanisms that are rushing in to try to kill this tumor that you're measuring. So we find, for example, and everyone who's looked at our data finds, lots of signals that come from lymphocytes, right? Now, why are they there? This isn't a lymphatic tumor. No, this tumor has elicited an inflammatory response, right? And you're measuring signals from the inflammatory cells, which are extremely heterogeneous. So it's a very complex problem. I'll just say that again. Now, if you don't get the tumor out, it will kill the patient. And this is really, this is just to be macabre. This is the liver. And here you see metastases in the liver. This is all colon. And if you looked, it would look like a piece of intestine growing here. Right? This is this poor fellow's brain with a nodule in the brain. So that's how cancer kills people. It's one of the ways. Okay. I've already mentioned this. Again, it's worth showing this to you because the literature that you're going to be reading will talk about this. One of the things we were trying to do in our data set that we failed to do was see if we could detect expression differences that were related to the stage of the tumor. Right? So A, Dukes A are the earliest tumors. Dukes B has gone through the bowel wall, like the one I showed you. B is one with lymph node metastases, and D is distant metastases, such as I've showed you. And these are the approximate survival rates. Okay, so when we started and our project, we had a few questions. And I'm going to try to convince you we've answered some of them successfully and some of them we haven't. Are there sequential and cumulative expression changes which recapitulate the genetic changes that I showed you and epigenetic abnormalities seen during carcinogenesis? That would be very important because then we would have two axes on which we could hang a taxonomy, DNA and RNA. And we could supplement that with the current phenotypic analysis. Can these changes be construed or used as a signature, ultimately driving a new system of classification which predicts prognosis and assigns therapy? The whole idea here, from the physician's point of view, right, is to develop a molecular taxonomy which is more precise and more sensitive than the existing taxonomy that I showed you, the Duke system. But that's the whole idea. This patient has this expression signature, she should get this therapy. This patient has this expression signature, she should get this therapy. That's the idea. The whole idea from the point of view of the biologist is to discover pathways and networks of A, new genes, and tying them to existing genes and networks. That's why I do this as the biologist. And that's the third part. So this is the medical question, this is the biological question. I don't know where the physics is in it, but I guess we'll find it. We'll find it. I have to tell you, just to take a little break, everybody was very impressed that I was coming here to talk about statistical mechanics. And they said, what is that, Dan? It sounds great. Right? And I have to say, I really couldn't give them a cogent explanation, but they were very impressed, all of my colleagues. Even my 13-year-old son was impressed, and you know that takes some doing. So there's another way to put this is to talk about the biologist tasks. What are we trying to do here? What jobs are we trying to do? And I've mentioned one as being up at the top, sort of biological and medical, and that is to develop a classification scheme and to correlate this with phenotype and outcome. Phenotype, I mean disease phenotype. With the point of having a molecular taxonomy. And I'm going to argue and show you evidence that the big problem with doing this, and it's been a very big problem with solid tumors, is biological and sample heterogeneity, which we can call noise and bias, and we'll talk about that in a minute. The other task is pathway and network discovery and delineation, and the big problem there is differentiating primary from secondary changes. Which of these expression changes is just going along for the ride, and which of these is causative? Prognosis and detection I won't be talking about, but implicit in the idea of this molecular taxonomy is that we'd like to have a better prognostic scheme. And one of the big problems that, yes, even you as physicists are going to face in trying to understand this data is that the clinical data that goes along with this stinks. It's bad. It's badly collected, it's not tracked properly, some of it's made up. So it's very difficult to try to correlate the clinical side of this, which is actually, that's the manifest phenotype. So it's important with what we see. And I can't tell you how vexing it was to find that things that that were billed as tumors weren't. And we're going to see. I'm going to show some of the data from Uri's first paper on this, and show you how that was important. People think about using these chips to detect cancer, and I'm not going to really talk about that today. But I will talk about gene discovery and show you some examples. Okay, so here are the databases, and I just to avoid confusion, because I know lots of you have probably looked at these data sets. The colon cancer database is in two versions, and they're actually both up at my website today. Version one is the one that Uri spoke about in the paper that he was first author on, and I think there were 62 samples, is that right? I was trying to remember last night as I wrote this. There were 62 samples altogether. 40 some of them were cancers and 20 were normals, which meant that many of the cancers were not paired with normal tissue. Okay, they were just there for the ride. It turned out that some of the cancers had no tumor cells at all in them, even though we were told that they did at the beginning. There's another version of this database, which is actually being published today in Cancer Research, which I've just called 1.5, and that's what I'm going to be talking about here, unless I specify otherwise. Okay, and this will also be available for you to download starting today if you want. This involved 18 bulk colon cancers, and by that I mean 18 cancers that I didn't dissect. I didn't just take that epithelial layer out. We threw the whole thing in and took the RNA from the whole thing. Very heterogeneous. We added as many as 8 adenomas at the end, precursor lesions, because we wanted to track the changes along. We thought that would give us some dynamic information in how these tumors form. And then we added 26 bulk normal samples, again, undissected. The RNA was extracted, labeled, and hybridized to this gene tip. And unless you ask me about it, I'm not going to talk about any of this, because I assume you've heard it before. I've mentioned the chip, and now we now know that each of the tumors I'm going to talk about, with one exception, were histologically confirmed to contain tumor. And we had some clinical data. So this is a fairly simplistic representation of the data. This is the expression intensity in neoplastic tissue, that is to say adenomas and cancers, compared to the expression intensity in normal tissue from the same patient, paired. Yes? This is pooled. Everything's pooled. So this is average data for each gene. Each gene represents a point. Each point represents a gene, I'm sorry. And so it's averaged. And, you know, that has its pluses and minuses. No. It's just that we don't do that. We average for each gene, gene A. Each dot represents the average signal from the neoplastic tissue compared with the average signal from the normal tissue. That's how this one is done. Yeah, it's just to give us an idea of the scatter gene by gene. Here's the line of identity, and here's a fourfold boundary that I took. And the fourfold boundary is completely arbitrary. It's just that as a biologist, I know that signal changes of 2 to 3-fold may be meaningless. And so I said fourfold, and it was also taken to keep the number of candidate genes to something I could tolerate. And then I colored each gene where there was a p-value less than 1 in 10,000 red. So the red dots are fourfold changes with a p-value less than 0.0001. Okay? So these are the real significant changes. Genes which are up here are more highly expressed in the normal tissue, so they're downregulated in tumors. Genes here are upregulated in tumors. Okay? Now, it's possible the chips contain housekeeping genes, and by housekeeping genes, I mean genes that we assume do not change, ever. Now, that's a questionable assumption. But we're assuming that the expression ratio in normals compared with tumors should be 1 for this set of genes. And so it's sort of an internal control, and it also lets us calibrate the chip and develop a standard deviation for this. And in fact, the housekeeping gene ratio, tumor to normal, was 1.03 with a reasonably small standard deviation. So actually, the fourfold boundary penalizes us. Right? The fourfold boundary is probably a little wider than we need. The P is the So each point is the average expression across, let's say, 18 cancers. So that the p-value denotes the probabilities associated with for each gene in normal versus tumor. So there are no replicates in the sense I think you mean. There are replicates only in the sense that we're measuring the same gene across 18 different tissues. Okay, using the fourfold boundaries and the p-values I mentioned, we found that about 2% of the genes are abnormally expressed. And we like that number because that's the same number everybody else finds. That seems to be a universal constant in cancer biology. Whatever global system people use, you find 1 to 3% of the genes to be abnormally expressed. About 26 of them were higher in cancer, and 49 were lower in cancer. And here are the magnitudes of change. Have you heard anything about the SAGE database? SAGE database. I don't want to talk about the details, but I'll just say that the SAGE database is another system for highly parallel analysis of genes. It's a completely different system. It doesn't use chips. And when we compared our data with theirs, it was actually, the comparison was terrible. Very little overlap. Out of more than 4,000 genes, only 19 changed in both data sets. And sometimes the changes were in opposite directions. So this is a problem. We don't understand why different methods of highly parallel analysis give different results. Another way to put it is we don't understand what mistake the people doing the SAGE analysis are making. Yeah, so that's right. The ones that really change the most are the ones that are present in both. So guanylin, for example, is a big player and it's present in both sets. So that's part of it. That certainly is part of it. I'm just going to skip. It's just the kind of list we get. So I just wanted to show you, I don't know if you've heard of these genes, but I wanted to show you that many of the genes we found to be more highly expressed in cancer had previously been discovered. And that's good. That tells us that that the data table we're developing is consistent with the literature. Some of the ones that weren't described in colon cancer have been described in other forms of cancer, and so that's good too, right? And then there are others that are just involved with the fact that these cells are rapidly proliferating. I know Joe DeRisi spoke to you, and he might have talked about the proliferative cells when he was here. So at least based on comparisons with the existing literature, we were happy with what we had. And the themes, as we talked about, of the genes, we found lots of transcriptional activators, as you'd expect. We found lots of chemokines, right? Now, there's a publication in Nature, actually, just last week, pointing out that this may be a general phenomenon in cancer, which we agree with, and I'll show you some data about that. We found lots of genes involved in matrix degradation, slipping the bounds that hold the cell in place and letting it move to another part of the body, cell cycle genes, ribosomal proteins and metabolic genes, and then a different group were down-regulated. The changes were fairly consistent. It's not just one gene biasing the sample. For example, guanylin we found to be markedly underexpressed in the cancers and the adenomas compared with the cognate tissue, right? And it was really a very clean separation. Conversely, if you look at the genes that are overexpressed, this is a chemokine that I'm going to show you, if we have time, some extensive work with, was elevated in most of the cancers, but not all of them. Okay. And this is another product, it turns out to be P53 regulated, was also over-regulated in the cancers, up-regulated in the cancers. Now, you didn't talk about this. Okay, so this is from Uri's paper. An algorithm that he and Nama wrote, deterministic annealing algorithm, and he applied it to the larger data set, 62 samples. This is the unclustered data, and each arrow points to a tumor. Forget the colors. And then they applied the algorithm, and as you see, there's a fairly nice separation of the tumors from the normal tissue without the arrows. So where there's no arrow, you have a row of genes from a normal sample, and where there's an arrow, it's from a tumor. And I should say, of course, that the along this axis are listed the tumors, and along this axis, the 2,000 brightest genes. Okay? So you see two things. This axis has been clustered such that the tumors are pushed up here, but there appear to be five mistakes. Okay? However, three of these mistakes weren't mistakes, the ones marked with a red arrow. There was no tumor in them. We'd been incorrectly informed by the tumor bank. Okay? So really, the accuracy of this method was quite good. There were only two errors. Okay? There were fewer errors in the algorithm than there were with the pathologist, which is a little alarming. Yes? Yeah, I mean, that point's well taken. I was sort of superimposing the existing classification that I carry around in my head on this image. And you're quite right. It might not be a mistake. It might be that there was that the algorithm has discerned a category previously unrecognized. So the point is well taken. Now, you also see clustering along this axis, and you see the ribosomal genes clustered together and seem to be more highly expressed in the tumors. And that's important because that's known. It's known that colon cancer overexpresses ribosomal proteins. Okay. Now, in part, this very clean, only in part, this very clean separation is an artifact. And it's an artifact of a bias which is implicit in the method of sampling. And that's why I thought it was important to talk about it with you. It turns out that because of the method of collection, it doesn't have to be this way, but it's just because of the method of collection, normal tissue from the colon has more muscle and fibrous tissue, more myocytes and fibroblasts than do tumors. And that's fairly consistent from sample to sample. Therefore, genes coding these products are relatively overexpressed in normal tissue. It's possible, in fact, we know it to be true, that this tissue bias drives this partitioning. Uri here has calculated something he calls a muscle index, and the higher the index, the more expression there was of a set of genes that he identified as being expressed by muscle. And as you see, the normal samples on this dendrogram N, tend to have higher muscle indices, 0.7, 0.8, than the tumor samples. Okay? And so it's that parameter which is driving this partitioning. You can, if you go in a post hoc way, select five muscle genes, and it will completely and perfectly separate the tumors from the normals. Now, colon cancer does not really underexpress muscle genes. It's just because of the sample composition. Okay. Now, there's a way around this, and that is to just use the epithelial tissue, right, to do your expression profiles. But that has its own problems that we'll talk about. That's called microdissection. This is taken from the publication, which is actually coming out in Cancer Research today, using the second data set, which overlaps a lot with the first data set, but which has been cleaned up and to which we've added some adenomas. And we wanted to see if it would be possible to recapitulate the known taxonomy with a molecular expression analysis. Remember I told you that there are at least three kinds of tissues here: normal tissue, adenomatous tissue, and malignant tissue. And I wanted to see if a clustering algorithm could separate these. And this is just a two-way hierarchical algorithm. It's actually Michael Eisen's algorithm, which we rewrote in Java and ran the program. Along this axis are the tumors, so it's been flipped 90 degrees, and here are 2,000 genes. Red means it's overexpressed, green means the expression's low. The order of samples was randomized before the algorithm ran, and as you can see, I think, pretty clearly, the dendrogram shows that this tree has two big trunks, and all and only the normal tissue falls into this trunk, and all and only the neoplastic tissue falls into this trunk. This trunk has two branches, a little branch here, and this has all and only the four adenomas, and this branch has all and only the cancers. So this algorithm, which was an unsupervised algorithm, completely recapitulated the conventional phylogeny. And it's possible, of course, to look here and identify a few clusters this is sort of like a Rorschach test. So I picked the clusters that I want to see. Etchen, I guess, has a machine approach to picking the clusters, right? So this is the human approach. Cluster 1, cluster 2, cluster 3. I'll tell you at the beginning that cluster 3 are the muscle genes. And they're overexpressed in most of the normal tissue. Not uniformly so, but in general they are. Right? Normal tissue overexpresses the muscle. Interestingly, if you delete all of these genes from the data table and recluster, you get almost the same image. Now, that just tells you that perhaps that the difference between muscle, between normal and tumor tissue with respect to tissue composition is very deep. It's not just these obvious muscle genes, it's everything. But it also might be that there really is a difference in the epithelium. Cluster 2 and cluster 1 seem to drive the differences between adenomas and cancers. So these are the genes that are higher in adenomas. And I'm not going to bore you by going through them, but many of them are ones that we expect to see in cancer. And many of them occupy a stage of abnormality between the normal and the adenomas. So they're a little upregulated in the adenomas and a lot upregulated in the cancers. And these are the list that drives the separation, the partitioning from adenocarcinoma to normal tissue. And it's the same kind of list that we talked about before. MGSA, a serine kinase we mentioned, ribosomal proteins, matrilycin, which is a matrix degrading protein. However, we found using this approach, even with a very clean data set, as clean as I could make it, that the system had very poor sensitivity. Very poor sensitivity. We couldn't relate the clinical stage. We couldn't find partitions that designated clinical stage, A, B, C, D. Prognosis, that might have been this problem with clinical information that I told you about. The grade, how abnormal the individual cells looked. And of course, the holy grail, P53 status. We tried every unsupervised approach we could think of, and we couldn't make any progress on this issue. And my interpretation is that the system is just too noisy for these kinds of measurements to be meaningful yet. So how about if we talk about this, then maybe we'll take a break for a few minutes. I heard I'm supposed to give everybody a breather around 11. Okay. I wanted to try to have a discussion about my understanding of the sources of noise and bias in these measurements. Because as I've emphasized throughout the talk, I think that this is a very vexing issue. To a certain extent, it may be intractable. I think that good approaches to data analysis may help sharpen the images that we receive. But I think that until those of us on the biological end clean a lot of this up, it's going to be very difficult to avoid these issues. Now, what are the sources of noise? Well, there's biological variation. People are different. They have different genetic compositions. They have different genes switched on and off in response to the same stimuli. They eat different things. The preparation before surgery is different. Some people get this chemical preparation. Some get this. Some get this antibiotic. Others get this. All of this biological variation will be translated into noise in the expression signal. There's a great deal of tissue composition heterogeneity. The surgeon may cut the tumor out this way in this patient, this way in this patient, this way in this patient. And so the relative proportion of the different tissue planes is going to vary patient by patient, even within the tumors, leaving aside the business of the normal samples. Okay. I've already explained to you that there's going to be a tremendous amount of variation in the surgical technique, the time towards freezing, right? Which is going to introduce all kinds of secondary problems. Cells begin to apoptose the second they're separated from their vascular supply. Right? So signals that we see that represent apoptosis in some samples may be true, may just be the surgeon was slow that day. Right? It's going to vary from center to center, depending on the bowel prep. So I think you get the idea. There are going to be all kinds of noises in the measurement. It's a very complex multi-step process. It's easy. Anyone can do it. But there are many steps. You have to get the tissue. You have to grind the tissue up with a rotor. You then have to extract the RNA. RNA is extremely labile. If you look at it crossways, it begins to denature and be degraded. Degraded RNA gives you an inherently different signal than pristine RNA, and we've seen that. In fact, we saw it in our data. You can discern noise from that. So that there are different techniques and approaches to extracting RNA. You're going to use total RNA, you're going to use mRNA. If you're going to use mRNA, how are you going to prepare it? Et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And then finally comes the incorporation of the fluors into the RNA, the methods of hybridization, the oven temperatures, the wash temperatures, the stringency. You get the idea. It's very complex, and it's not controlled. Everybody does it differently, and sometimes they do it differently on Friday than they do it on Monday. And finally, there's misclassification, and I showed you an example of that vexing problem in looking at the original data. So these are all examples of noise, and then here are some examples of bias, which is obviously a related problem. It's possible for there to be consistent differences in tissue sampling, as there were in our case. Normal tissue was just cut out of the patient differently, and that contaminated the whole signal. Sample preparation issues are very important. Achin published a nice analysis of our first data showing that he could separate samples perfectly based on whether or not mRNA or total RNA was used to prepare the samples. The people doing this for us thought we'd never notice. Experimental variation, if it's consistent, will introduce bias. And then finally, I've already mentioned obliquely the idea of the uncharacterized reference sample. We talk very glibly about normal tissue. But even if you get down to a single tissue plane, the normal epithelial tissue, there's no really normal tissue. There are normal stem cells and different ones of those, normal surface cells. So again, that's a source of bias. So before I gave up completely in trying to understand my data, I read a nice publication, I guess by Gotti, right, and Etchin, concerning our data set. And I was interested to see how they had looked at the original data set, and so I supplied them the cleaned up version 1.5 data set to see how they would partition the data. And they used the two-way coupling algorithm that I guess you've all heard about, so I'm not going to talk about it now. And in this first dendrogram, I supplied them with the sample I told you, and they were able to nicely divide the normal samples from the tumors. Let's see if I can get this to work. Show the data table. And as you can see, the division's a little different than ours. Adenoma, and then tumor. And then a couple of adenomas at the bottom. There's a single misclassification here, but then all normal samples. And as in our case, the adenoma normal samples are distributed randomly or near randomly with the normal samples from the cancer patient, and that's what you would expect. There should be no difference in the normal signal from a person with cancer and a person with an adenoma. Okay. This is a fairly large table of genes that drove this, and some of them are very interesting to me. There are a lot of kinases here, which are important in the signaling pathways that lead to cancer, but also genes that have previously been involved in cancer. No. Colon mucosa-associated antigen. So I think that this is a fairly interesting, well-textured list that I plan to study in my laboratory. Yes?
I think I missed a step. Sure.
Also from the patient. Same patient. These adenomas are usually found not at colonoscopy the usual way, but if the bowel is removed for another reason, you see an adenoma there. So for the purpose of the study, we'll take the adenoma. Now that introduces another form of bias. But, you know, that's the best we can do. Okay. So that's this now. If you use a different cluster of genes to partition the samples, you get a different result. I just want to show you that, maybe then we'll stop for a while. Okay. Yes, is this it? No, it's the next one. Okay, if you use a smaller cluster of genes, you end up with something that excited us a great deal until we look carefully. You find one big branch here, and then all of the rest of the samples. And if you look at the cluster of genes that's driving this partitioning, right, you see something very interesting. All of the adenomas have been paired with the normal tissue from the patient and separated from everything else. Right? And this is using a smaller list of genes, smaller cluster of genes, right here, which when I look at it is not biologically informative. So one explanation, one hypothesis, is that we've discovered a predisposition in the normal tissue of these patients which leads to adenoma, which is different from the predisposition which leads to cancer. In other words, it's not consistent with the unified hypothesis that I showed you. There would be branching and not a linear progression. But the correct answer, I believe, is that this is an artifact of the fact that these samples were run on a different version of the chip than the other samples. They were done later and the chip had changed. And these genes probably had different hybridization characteristics than they did on the first chip. So by a fairly subtle method of clustering, which constrained the table of genes, reducing noise to the level that a very subtle bias was uncovered, which I had missed when I clustered using all of the genes or a random selection of the genes. In other words, one concern that I have is that as these algorithms become able to limit the dimensionality of the system, reduce the number of genes being clustered, it may be that we begin to uncover more and more artifact by reducing the noise component. And that I think is what happened here. So should we take a break at that point? Okay. Sorry. Okay. So Yuhai was able to return us a vector of genes which he felt perfectly discriminated the mutant from the wild type tumors. And here I've just used that vector to drive a clustering algorithm just so I could show you the representation. And as you see, all of the mutant tumors, M, are in this branch and all of the wild type tumors are on this branch. And these are the genes which are upregulated in mutant. These are the genes which are downregulated in mutant. Okay. Now, in order to see if this was likely simply to represent a random partitioning and then applying a label, Yuhai did a jackknife procedure, and he did it by contaminating the learning set. He did it in a context in which he also contaminated the learning set with tumors that did not contain significant amounts of tumor, some of the samples that tricked us before. And the hypothesis was that as we contaminated the learning set with samples which really didn't have much tumor, less than 75% tumor, it would degrade the learning ability, the predictive ability in the jackknife procedure. And that's basically what happened here, although the numbers I've shown here are not precise. Okay? As there was more admixture of samples which had less and less tumor, the ability of this algorithm to predict was degraded. So that's not as good as taking a whole separate set of tumors and doing this, which is what we'll do eventually. Another approach I used to try to see if there was any meaning to this vector of genes was to compare it with an experiment which we had done, another chip experiment, where we irradiated P53 wild type cells and then applied them to a chip and measured the up and downstream changes in genes. So the kind of transcriptional experiment I was telling you about. And we found many similarities in the list that Yuhai gave us from our colon cancers with the set we did in vitro. Okay, all of these players here both discriminated wild type from mutant using the learning algorithm, and also were found when we irradiated cells and measured changes. So we think actually that there's some reality to this approach, although as I'll be the first to indicate, it needs to be validated in a separate set of tumors, completely separate from the one that was used in the learning set. And I hope I haven't misrepresented your work too much. Now, I want to move back to biology because I want to show you how biologists actually use this data. in the service of new gene discovery. And so I'll be talking about some biological experiments which, you know, may or may not resonate with you, but I think it's important for you to see what I'm trying to do with this above and beyond the sort of global analytic methods we've been talking about so far. Now, one of the first expectations I had when I looked at the adenoma samples would be that there'd be a relationship between gene expression, bless you, gene expression in adenomas with gene expression in cancers, because they represent stages along the development of this. And in fact, if you take all of the genes that change significantly in the carcinoma, I guess the 2%, and you compare them with expression of the same genes in the adenomas, you get a fairly stable and robust relationship. It's not perfect, but it's pretty good. So we know that there's a correlation in abnormal gene expression between the benign precursor and the malignant tumor, and that's what we would have expected. However, more interesting to me is to see how the progression of these genes occurred. Individual genes, as you move from the benign state to the malignant state, because this might give us an idea of which genes are important in that transition. Right? The first thing is to find a change in gene expression that's associated with a change in disease phenotype, and then to take these genes out and study them. So this were a group of genes which we have here, the expression ratio, tumor to cognate normal, in adenoma compared with cancer. Okay? And you see several of these genes really change. So this is twofold to almost tenfold. Some of these genes really change their expression during the disease progression. Yes? I only took the upregulated ones, thank you. And I took the genes that were significantly abnormal in the cancers and then compared them with the genes in the adenomas. Okay? And I wanted to track gene by gene because I thought that would give me the most texture. Because now I'm comparing RNA phenotype basically with clinical phenotype. Okay? Yes. So this is a ratio of an average. So I'll tell you how I got this number. This is the average of all of the 8 adenomas for that gene divided by the average of all 8 cognate normals for that gene. So this tells you that on average for this gene, expression was twofold higher than normal in the adenomas. And for the same gene, it was tenfold higher in the cancers. Okay, so it was abnormal to start and it got more abnormal. Okay? One, which is where most of these were, is normal by the definition we're using. Okay? All of these changes here were significantly different from normal. In other words, all of these numbers were associated with p-values, the ratios, that were less than 0.01. Very few of these were. This one was. Okay? So this guy here is MGSA. It's also called GRO-alpha, and it was at the top of the list. It was the most dysregulated gene that we found. And it's a funny gene because it's a chemokine. It's not a standard cancer gene. It's secreted by lymphocytes. So I said, when I looked at it, I disregarded it for a year and a half. I said, this is just due to the inflammatory infiltrate. It's got nothing to do with the cancer. Now, I disregarded it so long that someone who disregarded it less long published it in Nature last week. But we thought of it before they published it. Anyway, there's a story to tell here, and that is that if you look at all of these genes, right, let's say the top players here, all of them are either related to chemokines. This is a chemokine here. We did a protein folding experiment, a protein threading experiment, where we predicted the structure based on the EST. This is another chemokine. So 1 and 2 are both very closely related chemokines. They both have IL-8 folds. Yes? Okay, thank you. A chemokine is a protein that's secreted by a white cell to modulate the activity of other white cells. Right. It's like interleukin. In fact, this one is similar to interleukin 8. as is this, and they both engage the interleukin 8 receptor. So naturally, I said, well, this is just due to the lymphocytic infiltrate. It's secondary, it's not primary. This one we haven't identified yet. This is a metalloproteinase, which degrades matrix. And remember, I pointed out that cells are contained in an intracellular matrix. It's like the glue that holds the body together. And in order for them to escape from the tumor and burrow into contiguous tissues or metastasize somewhere else, they have to disengage from the matrix. And they can do this either by interfering with the receptor interactions that they have with the matrix or by degrading the matrix. And what I'm going to show you is that far from being bystanders in this process, these interleukin-like molecules are dissolving matrix, are causing the receptors to disengage from matrix. It's a fundamental task of the tumor. And these other compounds, such as metalloproteinase, osteonectin, these are actually degrading matrix. So I'm going to argue that of all of these genes are operating in the service of the same tumor-related goal, to separate the cell from its matrix. So I'm going to try to prove that to you now. So here are the GRO family of chemokines. Are you leaving already? The GRO family of chemokines, alpha, beta, and gamma. We mainly were interested in alpha GRO. They bind the CXC chemokine receptor, which is called CXCR2. It's a G-protein coupled receptor. That's a standard kind of receptor. And binding of this receptor ultimately activates a kinase, which has a transcriptional effect. Now, it's been known for years that this is overexpressed in malignant melanoma, a tumor of skin. But until we identified this in colon cancer, and now I think it's been identified in breast cancer, it had not been considered in other forms of cancer. One of the great values of the chip, of chip technology, is it allows you to move laterally across biology. You find a gene that's abnormal, you put it on a chip in one tumor, you put it on a chip, and then you can very easily test 50 other tumors or 50 other biological systems. So you can generalize nicely with chips. So first of all, we stained our tissues. This is a malignant gland. And in fact, this is not due to lymphocytic infiltration. This gland is secreting GRO. That's what we're staining for here. Okay, so this is part of the tumor. If we do a transformation experiment, a transfection experiment, where we get GRO out of a piece of tissue and bioengineer a cell which contains GRO and overexpresses it, you find that the cells begin to grow in foci. So this is the way a plate of cells normally looks under a phase microscope. These are all individual cells. But you also see in this plate the cells growing in big heaps or piles. That's a prime sign of malignant transformation. So when we put these in the fibroblast, we said, well, that's right, we can transform these cells. This is a candidate oncogene. Then you do a growth experiment. So you take several different clones that you've made, engineered cells containing GRO, and you let them grow in a plate and you see what happens. Now, everybody thinks that cancer cells grow faster than normal cells, but that's not true. Not true. They don't grow faster than normal cells. They just grow all the time. A greater fraction of them is growing at any time, and they don't stop growing when they should. And here's the proof of that. This is, my student just took aliquots, took different plates of cells and counted them day after day after day. We seeded with, let's say, 100,000 cells. And 2 days later, the cells really hadn't started growing, so all of the plates were the same. And then they began to grow, and they actually grow exponentially, as you know. And so they begin to double. At this point, this guy here tapers off, and the cells stop growing. That's when it becomes flat. And the cells stop growing because these are the normal control cells. And these plates have grown until the cells are touching each other. Once they touch each other, their receptors on the cell surface say, oops, that's enough, and they stop growing. Cancer cells don't do that. They just keep growing in those piles that I showed you, and they'll grow forever. And these are all clones that have the transgene, and this one doesn't. So this illustrates 2 points. First of all, that GRO is an oncogene. And second of all, that cancer cells really don't grow faster. They just keep growing forever. right? And once you get past this point, there's always a greater percentage of cancer cells growing than normal cells. Question? Okay. So that was another nice finding. Then we found, as had been reported in melanoma cells, that when you switch on grow, which we can turn it on and off in these cells, you begin to get an induction of RAS, and that's the KRAS you mentioned. RAS is one of the prime oncogenes. Prime oncogenes, it turns on all kinds of growth pathways. So this gene was turning on a gene called RAS, which sits at the right at the top of many growth control pathways. I'll show you a picture of that. And now we also had these kinds of insights. We had a loss of contact inhibition. It also let the cells grow in solution rather than on a plate. They didn't need to stick anymore. It induced RAS, and we know that RAS is involved in matrix degradation. And we also know, I have a theory of fellow travelers in science, that if this gene is changing in concert with a lot of genes that are known to degrade matrix to about the same level, that maybe it has something to do with matrix degradation. So we wondered if transformation by grow is related to abrogation of integrin-mediated fibronectin assembly. Does this gene cause the receptors on the cell to disengage from fibronectin so that the cell can then travel and metastasize? I just want to make the point here. This is fibronectin. This is the glue, the matrix, the intracellular matrix. It's secreted in an insoluble form, and it binds to integrins, which are a cell, kind of cell surface receptor, on the surface of the cell, and that activates the fibronectin, and ultimately you get a polymer, which is this very tough, thick, elastic membrane that holds the body together, basically. And that's triggered by these integrin receptors shown in yellow. Now, it's known from work by Gene Schwartzbaum's lab that activating RAS through a complex signaling pathway inhibits this process. It inhibits the ability of those receptors to clamp down on the fibronectin. That's known. And so we now knew that grow stimulated RAS, and we also knew that it seemed to get the cells not to adhere well. This is the formal proof that grow inhibits cell-cell contact. These are normal fibroblasts, and they're growing on a glass slip. It's just a glass cover slip. And you see that the fibroblasts are sending out tentacles, pseudopods. They're spreading, and they're embracing the glass in order to stick to it. That's how they grow. If you if you add some fibronectin, and you stain the fibronectin with an antibody that glows green, wherever you see green, you see fibronectin. And you see that the cells have assembled a beautiful fibronectin matrix, a beautiful lacy lattice of fibronectin, of glue, and that's what they're using to stick to the glass. Okay? You don't see the fibronectin unless it's polymerized. So the cells have caused the fibronectin to polymerize, and that's helping them stick to the glass. That's normal. Now here's our clones. This is one of our engineered cells. You see, there's some spreading, there's some pseudopods, but they're not really normal. It's not really, they're sort of still plump and round. They're not spreading well. And as you see, the matrix is clumpy. It's not very nice, not very lacy. It's not very effective. Here's a second set of cells which don't stick at all, and they don't make any matrix. So we now know that grow is associated with RAS induction. RAS induction is associated with inhibition of matrix assembly, and we now have the formal proof that, in fact, in these cells, there's perturbed matrix assembly. Why is this important? Well, tumors need to do this in order to grow, and so here's the final experiment I think that I'll show you. If you take these cells and you put them into a nude mouse, a nude mouse is a mouse with no immune system. They're nude because they don't have any hair, as you can see, but the same gene that knocks out hair growth knocks out their immune system, so they're called nude mice. And you have to use a nude mouse to do this experiment, because if you just take cells and inject it, tumor cells, inject it into a regular mouse, their immune system will reject the tumor. This mouse can't do that. So you inject a few cells, a million cells, nothing like this, under this mouse's skin, and you wait 2 weeks, and you get a huge tumor. A huge tumor. Right, so that's a final proof that GRO can act as an oncogene. It induces tumor formation in nude mice. Right? So we've covered most of the biological experiments that a biologist will use to say, this is a newly discovered oncogene. We don't know how it works, although the next slide, I think, gives you an idea of how I think this whole works. You'll remember that there were two genes, two types of genes, that were going up as we made the transition from adenoma to normal, to cancer. One was the GRO genes, and the other was these metalloproteinases. And I said that the GRO genes inhibit the linkage of the integrin receptor to the fibronectin matrix, and the metalloproteinase genes, MNPs, actually are proteases which will cut up the matrix once formed. And I said that this is a functional similarity. The tumor is trying to do the same thing in two different ways. And interestingly, RAS sits right at the top of both pathways. And the model that we're working on is that GRO activates this receptor. This receptor, in a way we don't understand it, switches on RAS. Through the RAF MAP kinase pathway, which is one kinase pathway, fibronectin assembly is inhibited. And we even have a drug that can reverse this. So we have a pretty good idea of where this pathway is. And through another pathway, the MEK P38 MAP kinase pathway, you upregulate the synthesis of metalloproteinases. And again, the point of this for this audience is to show how, in addition to playing very nice, very nice tricks with the data and separating out clusters of genes and trying to form a taxonomy, it's also important to just look at the data set and apply some old-fashioned analytic techniques, correlate in a crude way even, changes in RNA space with changes in phenotype, and then pull those genes out and study them using old-fashioned biology. I'm going to skip by this. Now, I think this perhaps can be a slide in which we can formulate an idea and a discussion. I listed some tasks. I've talked about classification, pathway, and network analysis, and gene discovery during this talk. In terms of classification, I talked about some problems in biological and sample heterogeneity, which I believe introduce noise and bias, and I believe that this is a major problem in trying to get down to really understand what the data is telling us. So what's the solution to this? Well, obviously, rigid control of experimental methods. You can't have a business where, you know, depending on one day of the week it is or which phase of the moon, you use mRNA or total RNA, you use a kit from one manufacturer, another manufacturer. Your biological techniques need to be rigidly standardized. You can't change the glass manufacturer for the slides you're using. You can't change the manufacturer of the floor that you're using. Because when these small changes are distributed across 50,000 genes in ESTs, which is where we are now, up to 90,000 actually, any small fluctuation in technique is going to be magnified and it's going to obscure the data, or worse, point you in the wrong direction. So beyond that rigid control, there are inherent limitations to the biology that I was trying to explicate. And I would say that the best approach to handling this problem of tissue heterogeneity is the concept of microdissection. Separating the layers of cells and the different kinds of cells from each other before anything else is done. Now, is that possible? Well, there are two general ways that this is done. We're doing this now in collaboration with a couple of groups. You can physically, under the microscope, dissect the epithelial cells away from all of the other tissue and put it in one pile. And you can do this while the tissue is still frozen, while the tissue is still very cold. You can separate the epithelial component from the smooth muscle component, from the connective tissue component, and you can analyze each separately, and then you can recombine the signals electronically to recreate the tissue in silico. Why is it important to do this? Why not just measure the epithelial cells and discard all the rest of the tissue? Right? Because it's very expensive. Each one of these has to be analyzed on a different chip. And I would argue that there are probably 10 components minimum that you need to isolate and measure separately. Why not just measure the epithelial cells? Well, the reason is something that Weinberg has pointed out recently. And that is that a tumor is not just a component, it's not just a pile of epithelial cells. An adenocarcinoma starts out with a mutation in epithelial cells, but there's a tremendous amount of crosstalk between the epithelial compartment and all of the other parts of the organ that's being formed. Remember, the tumor is a new piece of bowel that's trying to be created in the wrong place. So there's a tremendous amount of signaling going on between fibroblasts just under the epithelial cells, between the epithelial cells and the smooth muscle cells, certainly within the vascular component. And many of these signals are intrinsic to the tasks of the tumor. They're necessary. Much of the expression that you see from the epithelial cells is likely to be due to signals which are emanating from collagen cells that are just below it. Even though formally it's the epithelial cells that have acquired the mutation that's driving the tumor, nonetheless, the expression of the tumor, both in the phenotypic sense and in the narrow RNA sense, nonetheless, the expression of that tumor is being governed by a complex interaction of signals, a complex symphony, really, that's going on between all of the different layers that are talking to each other and cooperating. Therefore, if you just look at the epithelial layer, it's analogous to listening to Beethoven on a small AM radio. You'll be able to sort of get an idea of the piece that's being played, but you'll have no idea of the great majesty of the music. And you certainly won't be able to tell one conductor from another. So it's very important to divide, analyze separately, and then electrically recombine. So, and of course, they have to be combined in a way that's sensitive to the original proportions of the elements. And so that's a job for this audience. It's a very big job that I'm talking about. Right? You just can't add all this stuff back together. It has to be calibrated with respect to the original estimates of the amount of tissue in each compartment. So microdissection and reintegration, pathway and network discovery, it's very difficult to tell primary from secondary changes. Most people mistake secondary changes for primary changes. I'm a very careful guy, and so I've told you that for over a year, I mistook a primary change for a secondary change and ignored it. The only real way, I think, of making this discrimination is to use a system that's not at equilibrium so that you can look for dynamic changes. And so I think that that's a job for the laboratory, and you need to do introduce some perturbation to the system and then do time courses and see which is going up first, which seems to be going up second, and begin to modify the experimental system by taking genes out and putting genes in and seeing how this changes the dynamic state. You also, and this is critical, need to integrate it with DNA changes. And so Arnie and I have a very big grant that we're proposing now, and Juhai's involved and others, in which we're going to try to correlate the DNA axis with the RNA axis and the phenotypic axis. If we find a significant change in the RNA expression level of a certain gene, say, and we're then able to correlate that with an upstream mutation, then we think that that's real. So, for example, let's look at this pathway, just to give you an example. We find MEK is screaming high in a set of tumors. Let's just say we find that. Well, MEK is a gene that's known to promote growth. So how do we know if the MEK is elevated because it's causing growth, or MEK is elevated because something on another pathway entirely is feeding in, making the cells grow fast, and then MEK is being upregulated as a consequence of that? It has nothing to do really with the tumor. Well, one hint will be the following. If there's a mutation in MEK, an activating mutation, that would be very important evidence. Or if we see that RAS or RAF have an activating mutation and they're upregulated, then we can surmise that MEK is upregulated as part of this pathway. That is to say, it's a primary change, or it represents a primary change in the pathway. And so we feel very strongly that in addition to all of the work on expression analysis, we also need to do a lot of DNA sequencing work to make this information meaningful. Okay, so time courses and integration with DNA changes. And then finally, gene discovery. One of the problems has been ascertainment bias. You're only going to measure what you have on your chip. You're only going to measure what you measure. And the chips tend to be biased in favor of cancer genes. They're certainly biased in favor of genes which are highly expressed, because those are the genes that have been discovered. to put on the chip. Now, people try to get around that by incorporating these ESTs, fragments of RNA that you just pull from the cell. But nonetheless, there remains a considerable ascertainment bias, which, until the genome is really understood and all of the different coding regions are understood, will exist. So I think I should stop. I don't know if there are questions or everybody's hungry and wants to get some lunch. Or I guess we can continue this over the next day or so.